Welcome to the Money Insights Podcast, where high income earners come to learn wealth building strategies that will take them from high income to high net worth. With your hosts, financial and wealth building experts, Christian Allen and Rod Zabriskie.
Welcome into today's episode of the Money Insights Podcast, where we talk all things money and business. My name is Christian Allen. I'm here with not one co-host, but two co-hosts. I have, as always, Rodney the Pod Zabriskie. What's up, Rod?
Hey, I'm doing great. You?
I'm doing well. I'm getting excited for Thanksgiving tomorrow.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
Okay, so we've got Rod the Pod Zabriskie, and we also have, John, I need to come up with a nickname, but we've got John Reeves with us too, the newest member of the Money Insights family. John's a longtime friend of mine. He's an attorney that's been with Goldman Sachs for, 15 plus years. And he was an executive director working in the compliance world. And he even worked in the digital assets group, which I think is important because today we're going to talk cryptocurrency. But before we do that, I want to just make sure I hit on a couple of things. So yesterday we had our Facebook Live. That was yesterday, would have been Tuesday. And we talked a little bit about cryptocurrency. So this is kind of going to be a follow-up to that conversation. If you haven't joined the Facebook Live group, it is Investment Strategies for High-Income Earners. We encourage you to check it out. We do the regular Facebook Lives. We post content all the time. The idea is to build community, bring in people with a lot of experience in investing. We can work together and all kind of rise the tide, so to speak. And of course, we'll make sure that we're putting consistent content out there. So that said, make sure you do that. We also have the High Income Money Hacks on the website. We have, brand new on there is the 10-step formula to financial freedom. So we've got all sorts of things. I'm probably missing a couple of things, but there's some things you can go check out at moneyinsightsgroup.com. Okay. With that said, guys, let's talk cryptocurrency, should we?
Let's do it.
Okay. This is not a subject I pretend to be an expert in. I know enough to be dangerous, but luckily John has far more experience than I do. And so we're going to just try to break it down. However, we want to make sure that, as always, we remind you that we're not giving personal financial advice and always check with your advisors. If you want to talk more about this offline, then obviously we are more than happy to do that. Okay, so John, I think the place to start is to just at a baseline level, make sure people understand what cryptocurrency is. And maybe we should take it a little bit, a step deeper, and not just that like high level, what is it, but let's maybe go a step deeper and figure out, you know, maybe why it exists and where it's headed. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. So starting point, talk to us a little bit about just kind of what it is and kind of the way you see it.
Yeah, that works. So the way I like to frame crypto, good to be here. Thanks for having me, by the way. And I was part of the compliance team, and the specific digital assets team, by the way, at Goldman, I was a part of, was a compliance working group over digital assets, as opposed to, there's also a trading team, but I just want to
clarify. Sure. Okay.
I would love to be part of that trading team, but anyway, I'm more of a regulatory type guy at the moment. So when I first learned about crypto, I mean, I think like a lot of people, you hear about it buzzing around in the background. I wish that, you know, obviously in 2011, I put all my credit cards and all my net worth into crypto, you know.
So that's the advice. Go into debt as much as possible. I don't care what it is. If you've got to take out more loans on your cars, the house, credit cards, everything, throw it in, right?
If we had a time.
Just kidding.
Yeah, we had time. Christmas.
Exactly. Back to the Future Part 2, right?
Yep.
Anyway, so what happened to me in my personal story, which may resonate, everyone's got their own story. I through a friend who was very heavily involved in crypto, he built his own blockchain. He's very into music, and his idea was basically connecting musicians to the consumer and cutting out the middleman, because obviously a lot of artists feel that they're not compensated as they should be.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. And the idea was you can use blockchain to do this. Okay. So that's something I think kind of to start with. We'll talk about the currency aspect of it. But there's also this whole other layer to it that's actually more foundational, which is a network, which allows basically peer-to-peer related either transactions or verification. And basically, you don't need that third party, that central party, verifying it for everyone. It can
just be trying to eliminate banks.
That's the idea. So, exactly. So Bitcoin, and to your point, you know, 07, then 09, you know, there's this paper and then ultimately a transaction and then eventually available to the public in 2011. And it was framed around this idea of not having a bank. And basically, so I think about it, I heard, you know, online, there's a few great, you know, YouTube videos about it. You can go to for the basics. But the idea is that at one point, humanity started to trade, and we used to trade goods for services and so on. And some smart person said, you know what, we should have a form of currency, even if it's just seashells or it's metal, whatever. Let's do coins, you know. Then you get cash and then it becomes digital. And we were, you know, most of our lives, we're living this age where it's digital mostly. Mm-hmm. But the difference here is we're saying it's not just digital anymore. But because you have computers, and again, I use this example in the Facebook Live, I like the example of Uber, right? Mm-hmm. At some point, we all saw Uber came along. I'm sure we all had a similar reaction, which is like, do I really need this app? You know, and why are people so excited about it? What does it do? And I think most people understand Uber. Yes, you have a centralized platform. Uber, the company, makes that platform available. But you're not actually contracting directly with Uber. You're contracting with the driver, and he or she's contracting with you. And the platform allows that peer-to-peer exchange. And I think most people will understand that Uber is not going away, or ride sharing is not, even if Uber goes away, the concept of ride sharing or any number of markets that have now figured out a peer-to-peer way of transacting will not go away. And in my opinion, that's basically Bitcoin. So there can be all kinds of arguments about the viability of it, how environmentally friendly it is, you know, how much we should regulate and so on. But foundationally, it's in my mind, an evolution of humans transacting and meeting and coordinating together, basically.
Hmm. Okay, so John, I read a few articles just trying to get prepped a little bit. And I remember, and obviously the big news right now, we're going to talk about FTX here in just a few minutes, but that's kind of the big news. And the sentiment from a lot of people, and I'm sure there's two sides to this, but it's that crypto's dead, right? So you hit on kind of that idea of the viability of crypto. You talked about the idea that you believe it's here to stay. And I do too, to be totally honest. That said, why? Let's talk about why we think it's here to stay.
Sure. Well, and again, I like to use these analogies. I think about the time we're in now is probably similar to like the 1990s for the internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some of the biggest companies and names like AOL, you know, Netscape, Earthlink, you know, just aren't around. You had the whole...
Blast from the past. I'm impressed that you could pull those names out.
Yeah. Well, I like this analogy. So it's like here we are today. And the question is it all going to be about Bitcoin? Is it all going to be Ethereum and, you know, some of these other altcoins, Litecoin and so on in the next 10, 20 years? Well, maybe not. Maybe it evolves. Maybe some of the names change and so on. That's not too different than any other kind of industry or sector or scenario that's developing, especially at its infancy, relative infancy. Again, just to harken back, I do think Bitcoin's likely to be around. I think that's a little bit different, and we'll talk about why in a bit.
So Bitcoin is like the Amazon?
Yeah, Bitcoin's like the Amazon, or I would even go one step further and say Bitcoin's your www.web protocol.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
It's really foundational. It's theoretically, you could change it, but... And there's problems with it. It's not perfect, but it's pretty pure versus other coins. And anyway, and it's so big at this point. I mean, it's I think it's at least half, if not more than half, of the crypto market.
Well, maybe John, it's a good time to talk about what makes it different and unique from altcoins,
okay, right? Sure.
From other coins, just because, you know, for the average person that may have exposure, a little bit of exposure. Not when I say exposure, that doesn't mean they own it, but just, you know, hearing about it and seeing it in the news and those kinds of things, most people wouldn't know the difference between those.
Sure. Well, interestingly, there are other coins that are similar, more similar to Bitcoin. In fact, if you look at sort of what Bitcoin's meant to do, there's even some coins that do exactly what Bitcoin does. And depending on kind of your view and what you're after, might even do a little bit better as far as.
They just want the first.
Some people want, right. It's the first and some people, it's the largest. I think the point with Bitcoin now, it's the largest and it's by far, by levels of magnitude, the most secure by far. Okay. And the way to think about it is it's 10,000 supercomputers, at least. It's maybe grown from there, all around the world that are communicating together, that are solving essentially a math equation every single time a new Bitcoin is minted, and then communicating every time a transaction occurs and verifying that, in fact, they all agree that it occurred. And there's also no way to make adjustments to the protocol unless more than 50%. So you need 51% to agree, essentially, to make a change. And so the idea, so it makes it very foolproof as far as someone hacking or stealing your Bitcoin or something like that. There's other ways to steal Bitcoin, but as far as getting into the base protocol and doing it, it's not possible. Essentially, it's theoretical, but not really possible. So the idea of another protocol coming along and surpassing that level of security is basically not going to happen. So that's Bitcoin. But then
what is Bitcoin mining?
So Bitcoin mining. So Bitcoin started with a coin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then every coin after that, there's basically, I don't know how many digits, but imagine, I don't know if it's 21 digits or something like that, that a computer has to guess a number. That's basically what's happening. Hmm. And once it guesses the number, they get a certain number of coins. Okay. And then if it guesses another one, they get more. And so people started setting up their computers to solve these equations. And they started mining or minting these coins. Every few years, there's what's called a halving. There's like this halving so that you only get half as many coins. And so there's, it kind of trickles down. The idea is, I think in the next decade or so, maybe a couple decades, we're going to have no more Bitcoins and it's going to end at 21 million coins. Okay. So that's the mining process. But a lot of these same supercomputers are also, they're mining, but they're also verifying. They're part of that network. They can be two separate things as well, but that's how we get the coins into circulation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty interesting. So, and maybe you hit on this already. Is the main difference between Bitcoin, you said the security, the size, what else did I miss? What were the other main things to hit on when you talk about making it unique and different from these other coins that exist now?
Yeah, sure. So I was sort of starting with the idea that there's coins that are Bitcoin-like that do that same thing, and in some cases do a little bit better. But they're not going to exist, and you know, they're not going to either exist or they won't be as large as Bitcoin in the years to come ever. But there's a different type of coin entirely, and we'll talk about Ethereum, right?
Yeah,
which is actually quite different, and some people would say it's entirely different. It still works off of a blockchain decentralized network. Some of these altcoins, alternative coins, are more centralized than others, but in their purest form, they're trying to do it in a way that all the verifications, just like Bitcoin, are more decentralized. But the thing that's very interesting about Ethereum, there's a couple things. One, it doesn't do that math equation solve to produce new coins, okay? And these protocols are set up in different ways as far as how many coins are released at different times and to whom and why and so on. There's probably infinite ways to do that. But the big difference between Bitcoin and these altcoins, most of them, is that they don't have that equation. We call that proof of work in Bitcoin, okay? Which is what makes it extremely secure. These other coins will say they're also very secure, but they just have a different philosophy. What they say is if you own coins, what you can do is you can stake them with the network, and that basically gives you, we'll say, voting rights, for lack of a better phrase at the moment. So if you have a lot of Ethereum, you are able to then, you know, put forward how you want the network to be run and so on. And the idea is, since you own part of it, essentially, you're less likely to try to sabotage the network. Okay. That's what gives it the security. So that's proof of stake, which is much more, you could say, much more efficient. Doesn't take as many supercomputers and so on to like validate and so on. just by its nature. But there's an argument about is it as secure or is it not? But it's much, much more efficient. And so a lot of people argue that, well, that's actually the future for cryptocurrency and digital assets, is that space. The other thing that's super important to know about Ethereum and other certain altcoins is they have what's called the ability to create smart contracts, which is basically you can build applications like actual software that connects to the blockchain and allows you to. So, for instance, when I was working with Goldman, even the European Central Bank issued a bond and it was actually linked to the Ethereum blockchain. Okay, so rather than a typical, however they would normally do that with a clearinghouse or whatever, it was through the validation of the existence of that bond was through the blockchain itself. That's an example, but there's lots of ways to use an Ethereum blockchain to write a smart contract against. So.
Okay, I want to switch gears for a second.
Yeah.
Rod, I have a question. So let's move into just for a minute and talk a little bit about cryptocurrency as it relates to like personal finance. So obviously we talk with people every day and we give advice. We talk philosophy about all types of different assets. And of course we focus on alternative assets primarily, but Rod, maybe just talk about philosophically the way that you view cryptocurrency inside of somebody's like overall, you know, net worth inside of their overall financial picture.
Yeah. So the way that it often comes up in our conversations, obviously we have often some very focused conversations around our strategies, right? Investment Optimizer, Capital Avalanche, someone who is investing in a lot of hard assets, real estate, they may have a business, that kind of thing, and alternative investments, right? So crypto obviously fits in the realm of alternative investments. It's not mainstream. It's not viewed the same as Wall Street.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Like it's like it doesn't fit into like the regular alternative investing that we know, which is, you know, your real estate and business and, you know, like precious metals and again, hard assets. And then we almost have this new and just interesting. Anyway, then over here we have, which fits more in alternatives, but still unique. Anyway, sorry, keep going.
Well, it is. And what's interesting is often I'll hear the people who like the alternative investing space don't like paper assets, which would be things like stock, right? Mm-hmm. They may own a portion of the company, but it's not, they don't have any influence over the company. They don't have any say in what happens. They're just kind of along for the ride and hoping everything goes well. And they get an increase in the value of their stock and or get some dividend or something that becomes more tangible for them. And what's interesting is that crypto, while it is digital, so it's not a hard asset in the sense that like I can go to the piece of property and you know, walk the lot. But it's more hard of an asset than a lot of these paper assets, because
that's interesting.
There's scarcity to it, right? Which again also exists in the paper side, but it's like a hard digital asset, right? I can't put my hands on it, but with all of the security and verification and other things that John's been talking about, it fits for a lot of people. It fits more into that harder asset kind of mindset and the way that they approach it.
Okay, so if I'm getting on the phone with you, Rod, and we're talking about my financial future, well-being, what I have going on today, where I'm headed, and I'm doing a variety of different types of investing, right? But I'm also very excited about cryptocurrency. It's gone from, I can't remember the numbers now. What was the high, John? 67,000 or something like that? Somewhere in that range. Now it's down to like 16,000. Okay, so we're going to talk about this idea of buying low, right? I've been reading articles, and some of them are like, okay, that makes sense, and some of them are like, don't treat crypto at all like you would treat stocks. And so we're going to get onto that in just a minute. But let's just say I am excited about it. I think there's an opportunity there. What kind of recommendation would you, if I'm saying, okay, Rod, I've got a couple million bucks in my policies, and I don't have as much real estate opportunity today as I'd like. I want to still be deploying capital. Anyway, this is a tough question because I know it's individual, but
sure.
In general, what would you recommend people invest into cryptocurrency and, you know, things like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And like you said, it is individual. And I would also say, I don't feel like I'm qualified to make recommendations specifically as it relates to an individual asset like crypto. However, just from what I see and my own feelings on it, but because of the volatility, et cetera, we may say we think it's here to stay and truly believe that. And yet, like you said, there's no ignoring the fact that it has had huge swings in value over the last 3 years. Right. Yep. So you always obviously have to take that into consideration. And so I would say, you know, for the people who I feel like have been the most thoughtful, research driven and disciplined of investors, you know, maybe 5 to 10% would be a reasonable number, you know, for somebody who like that, who can get behind it, believes in it, you know, but.
So we're probably not recommending 50%, right? You got to be smart with it. Obviously, it's very volatile. We're going to talk a little bit about this more in a second. John, let's talk about that, actually. This idea or this philosophy of buying low, and again, we're going to get into the FTX scandal in a few minutes, but why would I not, or maybe the answer is I would, but from your perspective, why would I or would I not view cryptocurrency currently similar to like a major downturn in the stock market? And I'm saying, all right, I want to hit the ride, the wave that's going to come back up.
Sure. Well, I think I agree with Rod around everything he said, especially around volatility. But volatility does go in both directions, right?
So creates opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. So people, a lot of times they say, oh, the volatility, I can't invest. I'm like, that's exactly why you should invest in crypto. If you're someone who can kind of stomach the volatility. So it's not for everybody, right? I'm going to answer your question. I agree with Rod around the 5%, even when I was, you know, and I'm still very bullish on crypto, I would never put more than personally 5% of my own. And I'm relatively young and so on. I know people who put even 100% in, but again, those are people who know way more than I do. And they work in that industry.
They live it. Yeah.
They live it.
Well,
And
the people that I've seen who have a large percentage of their net worth, a lot of it, again, so this would have been a year or 2 years ago, is because they bought low and rode the wave high. Yeah. So just by nature of that multiplier on their original investment, it became 75, 80, 85% of their net worth. And again, it then goes back to the whole discipline thing. If the idea is to buy low and sell high, then if that's your approach, then you have to be disciplined when it is at the high and you say, okay, great. I am now going to rebalance, so to speak, to put, you know, put value somewhere else. But yeah, again, that's why discipline is the word, right?
Yeah.
And it's not that you can't change your philosophy as you go, but if that's the idea and that's how you're viewing it as an investment like that, then you have to be disciplined in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think in reaction to all that and Christian's question around why not buy and write it up, I think just recognize it's fine to take a punt sometimes. Right. And then you have to just assess again, how much there's a saying in the crypto kind of arena, which is don't put in more than you can lose, you know? And, you know, some people are treating it like gambling and that's maybe okay, you know, to go gamble, but is also recognizing that is what it is. I would again separate Bitcoin in the sense that, you know, who knows what could happen, but I do think that it's probably more secure than the rest. And some other coins like Ethereum are more secure and, you know, you can probably feel better, even if you see those swings, that your money's not going to vanish. Knock on wood, again, not investment advice, but that would be relatively surprising, even as far as the market has turned recently. So I think, you know, be careful. Don't treat any investment like a punt if your plan is to invest and not gamble. You know, all three of us know on this call, there's great ways to make double-digit returns in extremely safe ways. So if you're going to invest in crypto, make sure you find someone who really knows what they're doing. Talk to them. And your investment may have nothing to do with buying a coin, right? It may be that you start mining, like Christian mentioned, or you buy in a mining company, or you buy an ETF that's linked to certain crypto. There's any number of ways to make money through crypto. And by the way, even if you're going to trade it, there are very low risk ways, surprisingly, through risk, like through arbitrage and so on. Again, if you can find the right funds and the right people who know how to do it. But if you're kind of just taking a punt, you know, don't put in very much money unless you're a day trader and you know how to read the charts and so on.
Okay, good advice. NFTs, John, they kind of get lumped in a little bit with crypto because they're digital assets, but maybe just talk about kind of obviously NFTs aren't necessarily a currency, but just kind of compare and contrast them a little bit for us.
Yeah, sure. It's a good question. NFTs are tricky. I haven't ever kind of been personally very into the idea of NFTs or understood it really. The most I've understood it, as far as I understand what it is, but as far as like sure. The appeal.
Should we define it? Just make sure everyone has the same page.
Non-fungible tokens. Good point, Rod. And it's
basically it's a digital asset that you can purchase, right? Like a lot of times it's like artwork or, you know, I'm sure it sounds like there's a, you know, million different ways that it can come about, but my daughter always gives me, my daughter shows me like NFT pictures from time to time. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So Christian, yeah. So to quickly draw the distinction, you can buy like an NFT that's linked to like your favorite soccer team and like buy merchandise, your non-fungible token. So there's that type, but there's also like most people are thinking to your point, the artwork, right?
Yeah. Is it similar in that there's, so Bitcoin has limited amount, right? You talked about it's going to have 21 million. And again, I don't know this world, but I guess in my head, I'm thinking, is it similar in the sense that there's, now in this case, it would be just one piece of artwork that is that one, right? Like if there's only one of them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like a print.
Okay. Which we probably don't need to spend a ton of time on NFTs. I just wanted to kind of, you know, get a feel for it.
Yeah.
John, talk a little bit about stablecoin.
Okay, sure. So stablecoins, you know, there's the USD coin. There's also Tether. There's a few others in the US. There's one here in the UK that's linked to the British pound and so on. Mm-hmm. So, but basically what it is the idea is you peg it to something else and it needs to be backed one for one. So if you buy Tether, the idea is that they are also simultaneously buying a US dollar to back your purchase. And there's no way it moves your dollars onto the crypto network. So then you can buy Bitcoin, you can buy other things with it more readily, but you're backed by that dollar. So you're pegged. So that's your stable coin. But there's a lot of discussion that's really interesting around it, which is there's a huge amount of money in stable coins. I can't remember the quote, but like, it's something like if you combine all the money in all the regional banks in the U.S., there's more money in stable coins in the U.S. than there is even in all those regional deposits, at least during the height of the crypto market. It's a ton of money. And so the idea is like, is that going to ultimately replace the U.S. dollar itself? It'll just become, it's dollar backed, but it's really everyone's just using the stable coin. And that's more or less, actually, it becomes very interesting philosophically. That's the discussion that governments are having, that is the future of our own currencies, essentially, you know, a digital dollar or a digital yuan. And we seem to be going that direction. Even policymakers are laying the foundation.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
And instead of... Oh, go ahead and finish your thought.
I was just going to say, otherwise they're competing with the stable coins. So one way or the other, that's the way it's going to be.
So with stable coins, I've heard of people investing or putting money in stable coins that create some sort of cash flow coming back off of it. Is that basically the equivalent of a bank making loans, or like how is it that it's creating that type of cash flow coming like a consistent and predictable number? Like they're told, hey, you can earn 8%, 10%. cash or I shouldn't say cash, but cash flow type of return off of it.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that, but I think what you're describing is likely a crypto bank that is investing money for you. And so they're basically saying, we'll take your dollars. There's no real risk because we're going to peg it anyway. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to do is we can then therefore invest it elsewhere and give you a return on that. I'm guessing.
Okay.
I don't know for sure.
Because it becomes an exchange of sorts, right? So instead mm-hmm. of a central bank, so to speak, again, they're using the backing of a central bank because they're using the dollar or whatever, but they kind of fill that role now. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yep. And actually that raises a very interesting point around, like, as decentralized as the cryptocurrency space is trying to be, and in some senses is, there are these touch points with a centralized, you know, point of mm-hmm. contact that can be great for regulation and transparency in some cases, but then can also blow things up in the case of FTX, for instance.
Mm. Good transition, John. I want to talk about FTX. So we hit on this a little bit in our Facebook Live yesterday, but it's interesting to kind of hear about, like, obviously the news is with this FTX scandal, let's call it an FTX scandal. People are saying, like, is it the end of cryptocurrency, right? And again, like, that's kind of laughable because we were talking about this yesterday, how I was reading an article, and in this article, they were capturing all the different articles in which people had suggested the cryptocurrency was dead. And it was like something like, you know, 500, 600 times, right? So this has been like an ongoing theme for probably since it began. But the FTX scandal is interesting. Let's get in specifically to that. We're now in your ballpark, John, in the regulation world, but we're going to try to make it a little more fun and interesting. So take us through the FTX scandal, what happened, and maybe help us understand what it means or what, like, the potential impact of that looks like inside the cryptocurrency world.
Yeah, let's do it. And at some point we can bring up my slides.
We can bring them up. You should bring them up now. I think we should introduce the owner of FTX, and I forget the other company that you said he owned. What's the other name?
There's FTX and there's Alameda.
Alameda, that's the one I forgot. Okay, so those two companies are kind of, and the owners are kind of at the center of this FTX scandal specifically, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Break it down.
Okay, here comes the share screen here.
Let's see, do we need to let you in? Oh, here. I think I need to add it. There you go.
We get there?
Yep.
Okay. So
good looking bunch.
Left. Yeah, you've got Sam Bankman-Fried.
Okay.
He's gonna be like the next Madoff. He's currently Madoff. Everyone's gonna know him as that.
And there's Caroline. The owner. He's the CEO. I mean, multiple owners, but he's the CEO of FTX. And
correct. Co-founder, majority owner of both.
Okay.
Alameda and FTX. And the CEO, and apparently insane, which we'll talk about.
Okay.
They're going to make that. They're going to make that claim in court, probably.
Okay. Okay.
He's acting fairly erratic. Caroline Ellison. She's the head of Alameda.
Okay.
She is apparently in a romantic relationship with Sam. So that's okay. A bit awkward. we'll talk about all kinds of conflicts that are there anyway. Gary Wang, bottom left, one of the other co-founders of both entities. He's the CTO of FTX, or former CTO. And then Nishad Singh, one of the co-founders as well.
So this is a group of people you don't want to be bunched in with right now.
Yeah, so these people are. Yeah,
these people are very wealthy, but.
Yeah, let's talk about the wealth. So no, you're good. So they had enough wealth that they were doing things like, what do you call it? You know this better than me, Christian. The NBA, you're naming the stadium.
Yeah, your arena. I'm trying to remember. Okay, so is it
the naming right?
What's the name of this arena?
That's the FTX Arena in Miami.
Okay. Okay. Yep. That's a big deal, right? You don't sponsor NBA arenas. There's only 30 of them, unless you have a lot of money.
Right, exactly. They've got a Formula One sponsorship. They've got people, Tom Brady, his wife, Giselle, right? Uh-huh. Who were going around with Shaq and so on, telling people to use FTX.
Oh, wow. That is so interesting.
Yeah. So actually people are suing, consumers are suing these guys now, among other people, Katy Perry and so on.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Because they're saying you lured into this, yeah.
Oh, wow. So they must have had some sort of like interest in FTX.
Yeah, I mean, they were probably just paid to sponsor it, you know, but.
Yeah. I mean, Shaq's worth like $500 million. He probably invested a little bit, but yeah, so that makes sense.
Right. So.
Okay. So what happened, John? Like we know that it's blown up. We know that there's people who are saying this blow up could end the cryptocurrency world altogether, but like what happened? And then why or why not is it going to have like a major impact moving forward?
Okay. Should I talk about that as we went through the pictures or?
Yeah, sure. That's great.
Yeah. So what is it like? So these guys, they have math backgrounds, basically, Sam and Caroline, and they're related to people with those backgrounds, and they wanted to start a trading firm. I don't know when Caroline came around, but he apparently wanted to do either sports betting or crypto, which is kind of bad.
Interesting.
Kind of begin with a little bit. And anyway, they started, I believe, in Hong Kong, but they are now based, or they were based, out of the Bahamas. And I guess it's still there. And this is their penthouse, by the way, Sam's. He lived with 10 roommates there.
That's pretty nice.
Apparently he'd play video games as he was raising money, which is interesting. Very quickly, and then we'll get to the specifics. These are some tweets from Caroline. Nothing like regular amphetamine use to make you appreciate how dumb a lot of normal, non-medicated human experience is.
that's great. I love it.
Thing is, this morning I was lying on the couch reading a book. Then I decided to go for a hike. But it took me like a half an hour from that point to muster the energy and motivation. Actually, anyway, these people are like children, basically.
Smart children.
They're smart in certain ways. She was born in 94, so I don't know how old that makes her now. You guys know your math better than I do.
She's 30 years old. So they are young, right? Like they've had a ton of success and, you know, again, money. Unfortunately, it's coming to a screeching halt.
Yeah, that's right. So last couple points, you've got Sam with his Twitter account. He's tweeting all kinds of, people should go look at it actually and read about it because, or read what he's been tweeting the last few days. He finally stopped, but he's shooting his mouth off every time. He's trying to halfway apologize, halfway explain what's happening. I guess trying to not seem culpable, but he'll say strange things like, oh, my number one priority is getting consumers, my customers' funds back. And it's kind of like, well, why aren't they there to begin with? You know, what's going on? But he doesn't explain it. So.
Okay. And that's really the issue, right? Like the issue is, well, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of it. I want to get there.
No, you're good. I'm teasing this out probably a little too long, but you've got John J. Ray, who oversaw, among other things, the bankruptcy of Enron. Larry Summers compared this more to Enron than other things. And he says, never in my career have I seen such a complete failure of corporate controls and such a complete absence of trustworthy financial information, in reference to FTX. So basically, the Sam Bankman-Fried is running this, here he is, running this whole thing as a fiefdom, is what people are saying. So there's a question of whether they even had a board. It's not clear. And his decision-making, basically what seems to have happened, to get to your points, Christian, is there's been a lot of pressure on the crypto markets as of the last 6+ months or even year, right? And what people think happened is maybe in the springtime at some point, Alameda had a lot of losses, okay? 90% of Alameda, at least at the end of last year, was owned by Sam Bankman-Fried. Okay. So imagine that's a large portion of his net worth. He was worth around $16 billion, I think, at his height. It seems what's happened, and this is through an anonymous source to the Wall Street Journal, is that they took customers' funds that were in the exchange, which are owned by the customer, or should be, and they took those funds, and he lent that out to his girlfriend at Alameda so that they could bail themselves out of some bad trades, basically. So they thought they could do it. It seems we don't know, and everyone has their day in court, but it seems what's happened is they thought the market might reverse and no one would notice the difference. And who knows how long they've been doing this type of scheming. But basically the market didn't reverse. There's a lot of detail as to what happened and how it got really out of control for them.
So it sounds like basically the market is what shed light on what was happening in the background, like as to the extent that things were good, like no one was spending the time, effort, or interest to go look into FTX. John, talk a little bit about what FTX is, because I don't think we've gotten into what is FTX, the company, and how do they relate directly to cryptocurrency?
Yes, thank you. So FTX is an exchange. Okay. So it's a centralized, even though most of crypto, the goal is to be decentralized. Customers have to get their money into crypto. You can purchase Bitcoin directly through the protocol and get private keys, public keys, and you can own it. I think Rod has pointed out a concern, or maybe it was you, Christian, around like there's still this risk that you might, even if you own it, you might lose track of it and you don't have your keys anymore, you know? So some people say, well, actually, the better way to do it is through an exchange, as long as it's regulated and, you know, your money should be safe there, even though there's still more of a risk that you might get hacked and stuff. It's no different than a bank. So that's an exchange.
Yeah. Okay, that's helpful. I'm just, my wheels are turning here and I'm thinking to myself, like, how did they get to the point? How did things get to the point where they could even access people's money? Like that in and of itself seems really bizarre to me, right? Like, just because you're on an exchange, normally you wouldn't think that that would in and of itself give somebody access to the underlying dollars. Like they're not dollars, but the underlying value. How did that happen?
Yeah. So that all of your positions, if you were trading on FTX, I don't know exactly how they were custodying those positions, but they somehow had access to that. When they were funding, and this is all going to come out, you know, when they were funding Alameda, you know, I don't know exactly if those were actual like crypto coins that they lent out or if they used them. It sounds like they might've used them as collateral maybe in some cases. So I don't think we know yet exactly how they did it or what exactly how they funded Alameda. I may be wrong, but I haven't read that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, yeah. John, it's probably not going to give a lot of people confidence to go into the crypto market after one of the largest exchanges. I think you said yesterday in our Facebook Live that it was maybe the third largest behind Binance and Coinbase, I think.
That's right.
And so then you have FTX. Maybe the question is, should somebody, and again, I know this is speculation on your part, like, so we're just doing the best we can here, but should somebody feel comfortable or confident using an exchange at all, right? Like if the question is lose it on my own or have somebody take it, I guess I'd rather lose it on my own. At least I can live with that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's exactly the right question. It's exactly what people are thinking in the context of FTX. Luckily, Coinbase and Kraken, the number two and three exchange by size, are US based and they are US companies. Coinbase is publicly traded. Okay. So they get audited.
It's a lot more highly regulated.
Yeah. They are regulated as a financial institution, just like, you know, any other financial institution in the United States. The difference being that the products themselves, the regulation's a bit, you know, in flux right now and not established in most cases. And Coinbase is very pro, you know, defining that so that there's more clarity. Because one of the problems, one of the reasons FTX got as large as it did was because, well, according to Brian Armstrong, who's the CEO of Coinbase, he feels that there's some incentive for people to go offshore. It's easier to set up an account. It's easier to do certain types of trades and get margin and leverage and so on. Because maybe the US regulators have been a little slow to kind of define what's allowed and what's not, and then force other global participants to fall in line as well. So anyway, Coinbase and Kraken, you should be, you know, we would hope at least as safe as other financial institutions. Brian Armstrong is a very interesting and sharp guy. You know, I'd encourage people to go listen to who he is, and he's on a number of podcasts and so on. So FTX, I think the issue there has more to do. I mean, there are elements of the crypto regulation that did allow, you know, potentially certain things to take place, even in the Bahamas, that might not have normally have taken place, you know. But my feeling is I kind of blame crypto less for what happened. And it's more, again, the things they were doing actually push up against what crypto stands for and what crypto purists would expect. And it's actually, that's that centralization of putting money in the hands of individuals who make bad decisions. That's the risk. Putting your money on a blockchain that can be validated and is transparent. If you own the keys, no one can touch that.
I guess the good news about this FTX thing is that it will certainly create more scrutiny and more regulation moving forward, right? So, you know, it's one of those things where obviously it's horrible for the people who are involved and who potentially lost money. But as an industry, usually, right, when we have these kind of catastrophic events, you know, we can kind of figure it out and make things better going forward. But let's talk for just a minute about this idea. Like, we've talked a little bit about crypto, you know, still staying around, but maybe we'll talk a little bit about why, right? So why you believe that crypto's here to stay, and maybe just, you know, kind of speculate on what you think will happen in the future. And again, we know it's not financial advice, but yeah, I'm just curious kind of where you think things are heading.
Okay, cool. Yeah, where my mind goes when I think of the future of crypto and whether people should invest and so on, I think, again, I go to that 90s analogy we used. It's going to look a lot different in 10, 20 years, but the principles, the foundational concepts will still be there. So crypto is certainly rife. Don't assume, if you're listening, that you think that people who are into crypto and crypto enthusiasts, that they love every crypto coin that's out there. If you know what is happening in the crypto space and you understand it, the majority of coins you have zero interest in. You know, and I think most people really understand the space are really focused on kind of the top 20 or so market cap coins and maybe a few new ones with really good developers behind them. And there's so much gambling and so many people taking a punt on stuff that's really risky. I mean, I limited the top 20. There can be some other interesting projects that go well beyond that, but you really have to know who you're connecting with. So I lead with that to suggest, like, when we talk about crypto being around, I think like any market, it's just like any business, right? It's insurance agencies. You know, they get set up all the time and they fail. There's dishonest people everywhere. The same is true in any, you know, with real estate or whatever else. And certainly that's true in crypto. But if you're interested in the space, don't let that taint. Just because it's new and you may not understand it fully, don't let that ruin your perspective on the whole thing. Because the reality is you will miss an opportunity, right? Whether it's just to learn something or be interested in something. So a lot of times what I say to people, if you have an interest in it, again, go to YouTube or go to podcasts and listen. There's one called the All In Podcast. It's not necessarily just crypto related, but they talk about it. Brian Armstrong, again, went on a few weeks ago to talk about FTX. There's another one called Bankless that's super interesting. Go listen to these people who know, you know, volumes more than I do and been really embedded in the space. And you'll see, I think, really quickly, like, this isn't going anywhere. These are some of the smartest people there are, you know, on Silicon Valley and so on. But I think as far as the future and investment and where things might go, here's the idea with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin's a really good example. So Bitcoin was driven by retail for from its inception through 2011 up till, you know, just a few years ago, basically right before, you know, the COVID situation, it started to kind of climb, right? I guess maybe a little before that. So end of 2019, you see this huge spike, right? The reason for that was because we talked about in Facebook Live, Michael Saylor, who owns a publicly traded company, among other people, started saying, now's the time for corporates to invest in Bitcoin. It's just gone from retail. You know, there's a number of exciting things happening. Grayscale Investment Trust was setting up ETFs. A lot of news was coming out around Fidelity building infrastructure around the ability to allow various avenues into crypto and so on. So a lot of like big names on the corporate investing side were starting to really become public about their plans. That took Bitcoin, I can't remember to the number, but like up to, you know, 40, 50,000 maybe. And the idea there was that corporates were viewing it as something secure enough to put their own treasury assets into it. You know, if you're helping trade a corporate treasury, you're only investing in the most secure things that there could be.
It is interesting.
Yeah, and you've got Elon Musk saying that you can buy a Tesla with crypto, and he put, I think, $1 billion or so of his treasury into it. That's when the price just went wild, right?
Yep.
The reason it went to 69,000 was because sovereigns started saying that they were going to put their central banking assets into it. Okay. And, you know, there's smaller sovereigns, El Salvador, some people call El Holdador now on behalf of Bitcoin. Panama is another one looking at it closely. But the idea there in Central and South America is that their currencies are so volatile anyway, that actually Bitcoin is a really good, stable alternative by comparison. Sort of counterintuitive for us, you know, most of us in the West here. But also they have, in those countries, so many immigrants to America and other parts of the world that are working and sending money back home, that Bitcoin became a very practical way for them to do that without using like a Western Union, for instance, and paying exorbitant fees. They could just own a Bitcoin account on Binance or whatever and buy Bitcoin with their wages, and then their family can withdraw it. So a lot of people are realizing that for the third world, Bitcoin is an incredible solution. So anyway, when the sovereigns started to get involved, that's what pushed the price way up. So in my mind, as far as thinking about the future, none of that's changed, right? As far as, you know, the likelihood of that happening in the next 5-10 years, especially, it's very likely that corporates eventually, when the economy changes, interest rates start to come down, people start taking risks again, that will be a percentage of their treasury, and other sovereigns will start to adopt it. And so you can imagine, we've already seen that's where the price will go. With Bitcoin specifically, it's very likely that you'll see that again, is my take. But in the next, you know, who knows what happens, you know, if there's more with Russia or there's, you know, heaven forbid where that could go, right? That could really put a lot of pressure on the price still.
It hasn't necessarily hit rock bottom.
No.
But I think, like, and this is just kind of the common sense side of me coming out, like, I think if you're willing to hold for 5 years, then it's going to be hard to lose. Again, I'm not saying what to do, but I'm just, my personal opinion is that getting into something like Bitcoin that has the established kind of track record, like, it's hard for me to believe that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, it's not going to have, you know, exploded and drastically increased in value just based on what we've seen in the past. And again, progress, like, in general, like, it represents, for me, like, from a philosophical standpoint, it kind of just represents world progress. And generally, we tend to move toward progress, right? Toward making things more efficient. Before we go, John, I want to talk about two quick questions that I forgot to hit on. One, just talk quickly about the practicality of using Bitcoin, like, on a transactional type basis. I know that there are people who, like, you know, instead of taking regular payments, they'll take Bitcoin as payment for things. And then really quickly talk about, you hit on this, and I don't know if it's the most the most interesting part to finish with, but I want to make sure we touch on it. Will you just talk a little bit about this idea of the environmental impact? Because the other thing that I see is maybe a concern for Bitcoin would be that, right? But when I look at that, I still say what's more likely to happen isn't that Bitcoin goes away. It's more likely that it becomes more efficient, more energy efficient, and more environmentally friendly. Okay, that said, before we kind of finish up, tell me your thoughts on those two things.
Okay, maybe I'll start in reverse. The environmental one.
Yeah.
Because it happens to segue well with the idea of sovereigns investing. Okay.
Yeah.
If you believe that digital finance could be the future, the idea, it's less likely that sovereigns are going to take a huge position in Ethereum, as an example. Because even though Ethereum's amazing and can do, it's more multifaceted than Bitcoin. You can do more with it. It's essentially, you can kind of think of it a little bit more like a tech company. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's more centralized. And anyway, you could imagine a scenario where like the software breaks or something. I mean, it's closer to Bitcoin. Bitcoin, on the other hand, again, we're talking 10,000 supercomputers solving this math equation. Yes, it takes a ton of energy, but it is literally the most secure network in any form that humans have ever built. There's people who are crypto enthusiasts, or you could say Bitcoin maximalists, believe that it's literally the most secure thing humanity has ever seen. More secure than even precious metals on Earth, because you could imagine being hit by a meteor and those disappearing. But as long as you've got the ledger, right, you know who owns what. And so Bitcoin can't go away. You can't imagine.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. So you can imagine that sovereigns and even the US, you know, central banks would eventually take a position in Bitcoin if they haven't already, or if that goes public, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, yeah, it's going to be around for a long time. So that environmental aspect is as annoying as it is, and we never like to cause harm to the environment. Michael Saylor makes a really good point about it, which is like most things that are pretty important to us, if you think about it, they're not great for the environment. And so it's less of a question of whether it should or shouldn't be impacting the environment. It's more a question of, do people understand the value of it such that that's no longer kind of front and center to the discussion?
Hmm.
So. The value justifies the energy use, basically.
Yeah, like Christian, you could say Christian's hat, you know, and all the hats around the world and the clothes that we're wearing. I don't know what the impact to the environment is, but I'm guessing it's more than Bitcoin. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that is an interesting way. That's a helpful way from my perspective to think about
it. No one talks about, I mean, obviously we want to make things more efficient everywhere to Christian's point.
For sure.
But yeah.
Okay, so finish off with practicality. Practicality in terms of just like, moving, how easy is it to transactionally use Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Or hard?
Yeah, so I think the big issue with it is like you've got your currency in US dollar or whatever, and then you need to move it into a stable coin, and then you need to buy Bitcoin, and then if you want to get back out, you've got to do the reverse, and there's some fees.
So it sounds a little bit like complex to get there.
A little bit clunky, and so even they're trying to like make it more efficient where you can have like a Visa card and like you can buy things with Bitcoin, but like what's really happening is it's converting your Bitcoin to stablecoin to US dollar and back. That'll eventually become more efficient. There's a lot of question around like if you're using Bitcoin directly, can it even handle that many transactions? And how do we make that faster so that it's more, it's just more possible to do it that way? But yeah, theoretically, you know, the converse argument there is like, again, Michael Saylor talks a lot about this, and so I'd encourage people to listen to it. But he predicts that in the future, there won't be as many currencies around the world. That basically, again, looking at Central and South America, a lot of them will adopt Bitcoin or the other major currencies. And you'll have an app, basically. I don't know if you guys know Revolut. As an example, it's big in Europe, where you open up your app and you've got your list of assets, whatever they are. And it might be a US dollar, it might be Great British Pound, it might be whatever. But then you've got your Bitcoin, right? And you've got your other digital assets. And so that it'll all just become, and you've got your NFTs, by the way. So it all just becomes a little more blended and people can transact over their phone and it just becomes second nature to people over time. and the whole world is more connected and there's more communication.
Okay, I just thought of another question, and then I promise we're going to close up. My final question is, what's the idea behind having limited number? And in my head, I think of it like money. I'm like, okay, like if I have 21 million, like, is there enough to go? Obviously the value changes in it, so it's different and you can, you know, you can piece it out, but
yeah.
Do you know kind of what the philosophy around having a set number is?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's people with different opinions about the value of that, but the downside is people start to hoard it. In fact, this is actually really helpful. Let me show you the last slide.
Okay.
This is helpful to me. One sec.
Okay. I will let it in as soon as you get it up. Here we go. Okay. It's up.
Okay. Oops. So I got to go to the end. So I'm going to answer your question. This is called the UTXO age distribution chart. It's a little complicated, but what's basically happening, you can see at the bottom left around, I don't know what year that is, 2014 maybe, mm-hmm. up through to recently, today, I guess.
Yeah.
What's happening here, look at these bands. It's like this rainbow colored band. What this is showing, the darker colors are people who've owned Bitcoin for more than 10 years. Okay. Hmm. They've never sold it. So some guy or gal in 2019 was like the first person to have owned it for 10 years. Do you see?
Yeah, that is really interesting. And it's getting, like you're saying, that's increasing as time goes on. So there's more people grabbing it. And you can understand why you would hoard it if you think it's going to go up like crazy. Like it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. So this is one of the most useful charts. Again, you can look it up. The UTXO age distribution chart, because you're always going to have these warm colors at the bottom because there's people jumping in and out and there's people cashing in, cashing out, whatever. But by and large, you're getting those cooler numbers as time goes on, which says a lot about the value of crypto to the people who really understand it. Okay. And the value of Bitcoin. And actually, even though you're seeing the price come way down right now, I don't know how much everyone listening might know. I'm not an expert on day trading again, but the price isn't dictated necessarily. If you were to do a polling of every single person that owns Bitcoin, mm-hmm. that would get you closer to the true value of what Bitcoin is today, right? The fact that it happens to be trading at a certain number, those are just the people willing to buy and sell as of today, right?
Mm,
yeah. Which are these people down here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of panic and a lot of FOMO that happens down here. And so the public only sees that price. They don't mm-hmm. actually know what's going on here, right? So you talk about the 21 million coins. When those run out, as we get close to that, and more people go into this sort of cooling down period, the price is going to go crazy, is the theory. And so people think of it as a digital gold, is the short answer to that. And there's pluses or minuses to that. Some people say, well, that's not good if you ever plan on having it be a currency, right? And how do I stop presenting? Did I stop?
Yeah, you're good. Yep, you stopped.
Some people might say people are hoarding it, so then it's never going to be a practical currency. But other people say, you know, that's the reason central banks are going to buy it. And maybe Bitcoin will never be the global currency, but it'll be the means of monetary exchange between central banks. And it'll be some other type of crypto that's layered on top of Bitcoin that's faster to transact in, that will become the one that we start trading in. And the other practical thing, again, just to harken back, is the remittance payments. Again, if people working, living in the US, sending money back to El Salvador or Panama, for instance, their ability to do that. It's a very practical thing for them.
Oh,
so we're always seeing that practicality. And I don't think it'll be long before you've got companies like Tesla again saying you can buy it. We're now kind of, you can start buying Teslas again with Bitcoin.
Mm, interesting. Okay, John. Well, this has been a fun conversation on crypto. Thanks for hanging out with us, man.
I appreciate it. It's been fun. Thanks.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Money Insights podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Insights podcast. to learn more about the financial and business strategies discussed in this show, please visit moneyinsights.net. The views and opinions expressed on the Money Insights podcast are not intended to be individual financial, tax, or legal advice. Always consult with the appropriate advisor before making financial decisions. And if you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This will help others find the show and learn wealth-building strategies for themselves. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.